allies than by the horrible Taliban and its allies. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 was ushered in by shock and awe, which was one of the most ferocious aerial bombardments in history, killing large numbers of civilians that were largely invisible to the U.S. Media audience. You could see them in other countries' mainstream media in Europe. You could certainly see them in Al Jazeera, which was broadcast throughout the Arab world. Our mainstream media continuously hailed, quote, surgical airstrikes. A New York Times editorial called the opening airstrike on Iraq, quote, a breathtaking example of coordination and precision, unquote. The LA Times headline, Bush opts for precise approach. And Bush appears to be applying force like a scalpel, unquote. I argue that you cannot do that kind of massive aerial bombardment and apply it like a scalpel. But that's what the LA Times was telling its readers. By contrast to that euphemistic language, we hear today that Russia engages in savage bombing, more deadly attacks targeting civilians, more war crimes. And it's accurate. The Russian bombing and rocket attacks have been savage, and they've been deadly from day one to last night. In Ukraine, we've seen story after story, accurate, compelling, about Ukrainian women who have had to give birth as bombs and rockets are falling in their neighborhoods. Well, I tend to believe that pregnant Iraqi women were not somehow magically able to put their births on hold as U.S. bombs and artillery shells were falling in their neighborhoods. We just did not hear their stories. As books by Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman have shown in case after case, civilians killed by an enemy state, by a foe like Russia, are considered worthy victims, deserving of prominent coverage in U.S. media. But civilians killed by the U.S. or its allies, perhaps the civilians that have been killed for years in Yemen by Saudi Arabia with the help of the United States, those victims are often deemed unworthy victims, unworthy of coverage in U.S. media. In my view, if the U.S. public saw the civilian victims of the U.S. war on terror, which is experienced in other countries as a war of terror, I believe this war might have ended many years ago. Something else was different when Russia invaded Ukraine. Our mainstream media discovered something called international law, and they repeatedly reported that it was a violation of international law for Russia to use force against the territorial integrity of another nation to cross another nation's borders. When the U.S. crossed borders of Panama, Afghanistan, Iraq, it was also a violation of international law. Those invasions, like Russia's invasion of Ukraine, had no authority, no authorization from the United Nations Security Council. At fair, as each U.S. invasion was contemplated or launched, we would provide to some of the biggest news outlets in the country information about international law, including articles from the United Nations Charter, but we just couldn't get them to mention the phrase international law or violation of international law. And then there's this other mysterious thing that emerged when Russia invaded Ukraine, and it's called imperialism. Soon after the Ukraine invasion, I watched an MSNBC host indignantly, repeatedly denouncing what he called Russian imperialism. And as a lifelong foe of imperialism, I too was indignant that a powerful country like Russia was using force to try to impose its will on Ukraine. But I've never heard an MSNBC host denounce U.S. imperialism. Indeed, the existence of something called U.S. imperialism is so stubbornly denied by mainstream U.S. media that the phrase doesn't appear in print in our country without scare quotes. This is something someone else believes. It certainly isn't a reality. The truth is that no country has come close to ours in the last 70 years in imposing its will and changing the leadership of foreign governments, usually for the worst. You can go from Iran, Guatemala, Congo, Chile. You could come up to 2009 when Obama was the president and Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. And it was U.S. policy that helped enable a violent military coup regime in Honduras, helping it to replace the democratically elected government of that country. As soon as that military coup happened in Honduras, almost every government in our hemisphere immediately, vehemently denounced the military coup, but not our government. In the rest of the Americas, that's what they refer to as U.S. imperialism. This denialism about an imperial United States persists despite the fact that our country maintains more than 750 military bases today in nearly 80 foreign countries. Russia has 20 foreign bases in a half dozen countries. Our military budget dwarfs that of every single other country. It's more than 10 times bigger than Russia's military budget. And the U.S. is by far the biggest exporter of military weapons throughout the world, including offering weapons and military training to 40 of the 50 most oppressive governments on Earth. That should be a news story. Corporate centrist outlets, corporate liberal outlets, whatever you want to call them, from MSNBC to the New York Times, they often report on and criticize the domestic gun manufacturers and the NRA for flooding our nation with guns, but not so much regarding the U.S. government and U.S. weapons companies flooding the world, including dictatorships, with military weaponry. I've never heard that discussion in mainstream media. Through either omission or obsession, our mainstream media have the ability to normalize the abnormal, to make the irrational seem like common sense. At the end of December of last year, President Biden signed a record-breaking $858 billion Pentagon budget. As usual, Congress allocated more money for the military, and about half of it goes to military contractors, these companies I've referred to a few times. They allocated more money than the generals had asked for. So most of the federal discretionary budget, that's the budget that's not Social Security or Medicare, it goes to the military. Is that rational? Should that be debated in media? The Department of Energy next year will spend $30 billion on nuclear weapons, including modernization, is what the word they use, and only $4 billion on renewable energy or energy efficiency. Given the climate crisis, these priorities should seem crazy, but not if you get your news from mainstream media, which generally ignores the United States nuclear arsenal. And if you wonder why other countries have universal health coverage and free or very inexpensive higher education, while in our country, we have tens of millions of people with no health coverage and millions of people deeply in debt simply because they went to college. A big explanation for this dichotomy, this difference, is our country's uniquely huge military budget, which diverts money away from money that could be going to healthcare, housing, environment, education. Why is the military budget so off limits to mainstream media debate? I'm going to wind down now by pointing out that so far this evening, I focused on prestige outlets, mainstream centrist outlets, or corporate liberal outlets, whatever you want to call them. But I also monitor the growing right-wing media sector. Most Republicans don't get their news from the New York Times or CNN or NPR, but from corporate right-wing sources like Fox News Channel, Talk Radio, Breitbart, Newsmax, Steve Bannon's War Room, Charlie Kirk's television show, all of which I consume almost daily. These people also get fed a steady stream of fanciful but very scary conspiracies through so-called social media. So you have millions of people being bombarded daily by propaganda encouraging them to distrust actual journalists, to distrust democratic elections, to poo-poo the climate crisis, to not only fear, but to despise liberals, progressives, immigrants, Muslims, trans people, etc., with a growing number of Republicans telling mainstream media pollsters that they believe violence may be necessary to save the country. So you have right-wing media helping to drive this extremism. A giant step in building the right-wing media can be attributed to Democratic President Bill Clinton, who, working with top congressional Republicans, was able to shove through the very corrupt Telecommunications Act of 1996. It helped Rupert Murdoch build the Fox empire. It helped Clear Channel, now iHeartRadio, and other companies build conservative talk radio. It helped build the right-wing Sinclair Broadcast Group, which now owns or operates nearly 200 local TV stations nationwide. Prior to Clinton's Telecommunication Act, one individual or company could only own a dozen television stations nationwide. They operate that many in Florida alone. And polls consistently show that the public finds local television news more trustworthy than other news sources. I can't explain it, I'm just reporting the polls. How the media over the decades has concentrated in fewer and fewer hands of bigger and bigger corporations is often projected by the media as sort of a natural process. This is what's inevitably going to happen. No, it happened because of corruption. It happened behind closed doors. The 1996 Telecommunications Act that did a lot to build the right-wing media was basically written by lobbyists for the telecommunications giants and the media giants for their own benefit. And, you know, I've been involved in politics and media for enough decades that I can remember going back years that there's always panaceas. There's social movements and advocates that say, if we just did this, our country would be back on track again. You know, I've often heard people say, and I tend to agree with this argument, if we just had campaign finance reform and, you know, the big corporations couldn't fund the campaigns and thereby have so much control over the politicians, America would be great again. You often hear from the right wing various panaceas. For years, I used to hear that America went to hell when the Supreme Court ruled that prayer in public schools was not constitutional. And so you always would hear people, if we just returned prayer to the public schools, America would be great again. Well, I've heard all of these arguments over the decades. Here's one argument I've never heard. If we could just move from where one individual is only allowed to own a half dozen television stations across the country, a half dozen AM stations, a half dozen FM stations, we just remove those caps. So one individual could own, or one company, 200 television stations. Or in the case of Clear Channel, right after this act went into effect, 1,200 radio stations. Gee, America would be great again. Public advocacy of that position has never happened because it's a crazy position. And when you know that there's something that cannot be uttered because people right, left, and center would not stand for it, giving all this media and public opinion shaping power to one company to own all of these stations, no one would stand for it. And yet, beginning in the late 70s, early 80s, especially with Reagan, this is what's happened. And it's happened behind closed doors in corrupt ways. I was very active trying to stop the telecommunications bill from becoming law. The Media Watch organization FAIR was part of a coalition that was organizing to try to stop this thing. and a consumer group was able to raise money to pay for an ad on CNN saying that this telecommunications bill, if it becomes law, is going to be horrible for consumers and it's going to allow all this media concentration. CNN would not take their money. CNN, which takes money for almost any kind of a political ad, wouldn't run that one. And these consumer groups were referring to the telecommunications bill as the Time Warner Enrichment Act, which is what it was. And what's ironic is shortly after Bill Clinton signed this bill into law, Time Warner, I think it was the biggest conglomerate at the time, it then took over Turner Broadcasting and CNN. This is 1996, 97. And then in 2004, Ted Turner, who was sort of a mad genius that started CNN, he wrote an essay denouncing the conglomeration of the U.S. news media and the censorship that media concentration leads to. And according to Ted Turner, he tried to get his essay published in mainstream dailies, but none would take it. If you want to look it up, you could probably find it online. He ended up publishing it in the very much smaller Washington Monthly magazine. I'll finish up with some good news in the U.S. media realm, and that's that for two decades, thanks in part to the internet, we've seen the growth of independent, non-conglomerated outlets. These often underfunded independent outlets, they may not focus much on the British royal family or on the Kardashians, but without corporate owners and corporate sponsors, they're able not only to investigate the biggest stories in the country, but to investigate the most powerful economic interests in our society. Here in Gainesville, you can hear Democracy Now! On low power, WGOT-FM. If you add together the national audiences of Democracy Now!, TheIntercept.com, TheNation.com, Salon.com, TruthOut.org, CommonDreams.org, Alternative Radio, and dozens of others, for the first time in our country's history, millions of people have access every day to journalistically serious, non-corporate news. These outlets don't have huge marketing budgets. So it's up to those of us who know about these outlets, including local community radio, to support them financially and to use our email, use our social media, use our word of mouth to spread the word about them. I'm going to stop here and take your questions. Yeah, I'll repeat the question. Some of us who watched the Super Bowl noticed they should go into one of these luxury booths and Elon Musk was sitting next to Rupert Murdoch, two media moguls, billionaires. And billionaires have increasingly been buying up the media. What does that say about the state we're in and the need for independent journalism? One thing that's happening, and there's a new documentary coming out called Stripped for Parts, and it shows how private equity companies have been buying up newspapers and wrecking them across the country. And one thing that major dailies or even minor dailies have always owned is a big piece of real estate in downtown. And so these private equity firms buy up these newspapers, sell them, lay off the journalists, and keep the real estate. And so there's no doubt that what the billionaires and corporate concentration, how it's ruined industry after industry in our country, it's made industry after industry less competitive. Well, media is one of those industries. And it's one of the more important industries, because if you don't have a free media, you can't have a democracy. Yes, great question. Given the state of the media, what path do I suggest to young journalists? I taught for 10 years in the journalism department of Ithaca College from 2008 to 2018. And that's newspapers were in free fall. And my specialty in the class that I taught every semester was independent media. And what we discussed in that class is that some of these independent outlets are paying decent salaries, Maybe not what you'd get at the New York Times or NBC News, but they're paying decent salaries. If I was starting out in journalism today, that's where I'd want to work. Yeah. The question is a simple one with a lot of information that the local newspaper here used to have a lot of reporters covering this metropolitan area and was taken over, now owned by Gannett, which is owned by Alden Capital, which is owned by, you're saying, some firm in Japan. This is what's wrong with corporate capitalism. You know, you can't have a free society. You can't have a democracy without free media, without an informed public. I mean, those two things go together. If there isn't an informed electorate, you can't have democracy. And our media system just keeps shrinking. We have all these places that are information deserts. They're media deserts. Bob McChesney, the great media scholar, he's pointed out that in other countries, newspapers were not as devastated by the internet as our country. That in our country, prior to the coming of the internet, which took away so much of the advertising, Facebook, Google, took away advertising from a traditional legacy media. But before that happened, because of Gannett, because of the chaining of the newspapers that was already allowed to go on here, because of neoliberalism and the failure to enforce antitrust laws going back to the 80s, newspapers used to be profit centers. If you had a newspaper, it was like a license to print money. Right before the internet, the people that own newspapers like Gannett, and they own dozens and dozens of them, they were demanding a 20% return on investment, which is huge. And so, as many have pointed out, especially Bob McChesney and other media historians, media scholars, it's because of corporate greed and corporate consolidation that newspapers in this country could not withstand the advent of the internet. And it's been withstood better in other countries. So, I mean, part of it is we haven't had antitrust enforcement in this country, and the media have been allowed to concentrate and concentrate. It's what I talked about, that corrupt policy where these things happen behind closed doors. The lobbyists write the rules, the lobbyists write the laws, and we ended up with the media system that we have, which is a nightmare. And it feeds the right-wing conspiracies that motivate so many people, including those who rioted at the Capitol on January 6th. Yes, a good question. This questioner is very familiar with some of these national news outlets. Is there a model for a local independent news outlet? There's a lot of knowledge sharing by independent news websites that are covering City Hall in their place, covering the school board in their place. It's often just two or three journalists. Many of them are refugees from the mainstream daily in town who lost their jobs. And they've started these websites. Some of them have broken big stories. Some of them have brought down politicians. In Minnesota, it's called the Min Post. There's some in small towns. So, I mean, the way around the need for millions and millions of dollars is to utilize the internet, not only for researching the news, but for distributing your content through an exciting a website that isn't overly expensive. But yeah, if you go look for independent nonprofit local websites, you'll find them in cities and towns, especially in some college towns. The policy options, the policy knowledge is there. You break up the media conglomerates. You go back to the old rules where one individual or company can only own, say, 5 FM, 5 AM, and 5 TV stations across the whole country. You make sure there's women ownership, people of color ownership. And then you create something we've never had in our country, but they have it in other countries. You remember I gave out the dollar amounts for how much public money, tax money, goes to public broadcast. We need to create something new in this country called independent public broadcasting. We need a public trust fund for public broadcasting. We need people to be able to divert tax money to independent nonprofit journalism. We need to break up the monopolies. And then we'd have a mixed media system, different kinds of media outlets, and we might have an informed electorate. and we might save democracy.
You were just listening to Jeff Cohen, Break Up the Media Monopolies. He spoke in mid-February. Jeff Cohen, a leading media critic, is the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Medea Benjamin, Angela Davis, Juan Gonzalez, Michael Parenti, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And we have a series of programs with Ben Bagdikian. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Jeff Cohen, Break Up the Media Monopolies, and for Noam Chomsky's book, Notes on Resistance, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Civic Media Center in Gainesville, Florida. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.